thought I'd devote to Lincoln's legacy, political and economic legacies. And this is a big topic, of course. You could write a dozen books about this. But I'm going to try to hit what I think are some of the highlights of the consequences of what Lincoln did. And well, starting with Reconstruction, of course, there would not have been Reconstruction had there not been the destruction of the war. And there would not have been a war if someone like James Buchanan had been elected or reelected instead of Lincoln, and if slavery had been ended peacefully like the rest of the world did. And so I thought I'd make some comments on some of the aspects of Reconstruction, which I blame Lincoln on as much as anybody. Even though he was dead, it would not have happened had he not done what he did. And so I'm going to quote William Archibald Dunning. When I did my research on Reconstruction, I found that William Archibald Dunning was a history professor at Columbia University in the early 20th century. And he wrote some really outstanding scholarly books on the Civil War that are still in print. I got them in the libraries. I think they've been reprinted by some book exchanges in recent years. And one of them is called The Civil War and Reconstruction. And you read these books and you get a totally different view of what you get from the contemporary readings on the so-called Civil War. You can't tell whether Dunning has any biases or not. The scholarship is just remarkable. And if you really want to learn about what happened during Reconstruction, I recommend that book first, because the other ones by such people as the Marxist Eric Foner, who wrote a famous book on Reconstruction, are just filled with political spin, page after page after page. But here's one of the things he said about, in general, of what happened during Reconstruction. In the South, where, of course, the Southern states were under military dictatorships, the governors were all appointed by the Republican Party, as were the mayors of the cities. So it was totally a political dictatorship run by the Republican Party for 10 years after the war. And here's what they did. According to Dunning, who produced many students, by the way, who wrote dissertations at Columbia on different aspects of Reconstruction, among other things, the expenses of the governments were largely increased. Offices were multiplied in all departments of government. Salaries were made more worthy of the now regenerated and progressive commonwealths. Costly enterprises were undertaken. He's referring to building railroad tracks. But the result of all this was promptly seen in an expansion of state debts and an increase of taxation that to the property owning class were appalling and ruinous. And indeed they were. So the Republican Party took over the Southern states. They gave the right to vote to the adult male ex-slaves, and for a while disenfranchised the adult white males. And so the ex-slaves helped in the looting of the South after the war. For example, property taxes were increased enormously at a time when the whole place was devastated and destroyed by the war. And what it needed, of course, was a moratorium on property taxes for at least 10 years, but instead they were increased. For example, the property taxes in South Carolina by 1872 were 30 times higher than they were in 1860. And so federal tax collectors would go down there, federal tax collectors, try to collect the property tax. And either they would collect bribes from the property owners to look the other way and to pretend that the tax was paid, or they would keep the tax money themselves. Andrew Johnson, when he was president, sent a man down to find out what's going on down there. Why is there so little revenue coming into the treasury from these taxes? And he concluded in a report that I quote in my book, The Real Lincoln, that this is what was happening. The tax collectors were keeping the money. There were also special taxes placed on cotton at a time, again, when they needed a tax exemption, tax moratorium. Special taxes are placed on cotton so that the Republican Party hacks who had these jobs would go down there and either take bribes from the cotton farmers, or they would confiscate the cotton and sell it themselves and make money that way. And so as a result of this, at one point during Reconstruction, one-fifth of the entire state of Mississippi was for sale because the property owners could not pay the property taxes. And so this was a way of transferring vast amounts of property, not to the former slaves, but to the political party hacks, the so-called carpetbaggers, who were the main beneficiaries. The poor ex-slaves got nothing from the Republican Party in the South. And another thing that happened, another aspect of Reconstruction, was that since the adult male ex-slaves were enfranchised, they were put into political offices in some cases, in state assemblies, for example. So they collaborated with the Republican Party for 10 years in this enormous tax heist. And very little was done with the money, by the way. As I write in The Real Lincoln, they began building railroad lines of all kinds. Very few of them actually were finished. They created a huge public debt, and not just taxes, but debt. They issued bonds to supposedly build all these railroads, and very few of them actually got built. Much of the money was stolen. What else would you expect from government? And then all of a sudden, when Reconstruction ended, the army left. Now, there was no more military occupation. They just walked away. And here you had the ex-slaves who had been collaborating with the party of Lincoln for 10 years, and essentially 10 years of political plunder, were left as the victims of revenge of the white population. And so the white population did take the revenge with the Ku Klux Klan and institutionalized segregation of all kinds. And in my book, I quote one of Lincoln's generals, General Don Piatt, P-I-A-T-T, is how he spells his name. And he was a newspaper editor in Washington, D.C. after the war. And he was also a personal friend of Lincoln's. And here's what he said after observing all of this. He said that, quote, all race antagonism in the South, all, he says, came from the carpetbaggers using the Negro votes to get their fingers into the Treasury, end quote. And so he didn't say that race relations were wonderful in the South before the war, but it doesn't take a historian or a psychologist to understand that if you use these ex-slaves as political pawns for 10 years to rip off the white population of the South and then all of a sudden leave them defenseless, bad things are going to happen, and they did. And so so you can even make the case that part of Lincoln's legacy was to make race relations much worse than they would normally have been in the southern states, especially. As far as economic policy, Lincoln signed 10 tariff increasing bills while he was president, and by the time he was assassinated, the average tariff rate was up around 47%, and it remained in that range for 50 years. It wasn't until the income tax came in 1913 that the tariff rate was actually lowered. And so what this means is all during this time, international trade accounted for less than 10% of the U.S. economy. So it wasn't exactly a calamity. It affected roughly 10% or less of the economy. But it was harmful to trade, and therefore it diminished the advantages of the international division of labor that Americans and others would have benefited from. And so the economic growth that took place in the post-Civil War era took place despite the fact that there was this large hindrance on trade, primarily for the benefit of the manufacturing interests who bankrolled the Republican Party. Now, some things never change. And so another thing that happened as a result of this policy is that farmers everywhere, southern farmers, midwestern farmers, farmers everywhere, were especially disproportionately plundered by these protectionist tariffs, as farmers always are, always have been in America, because for one thing, they, like everyone else, had to pay more for the manufactured goods that they bought, including farm machinery, farm tools, clothing, shoes, etc. But the major American export at that time was food, agricultural products. And so when you block off trade and you impoverish your trading partners, they have fewer dollars with which to buy American goods. And primarily the American goods they were buying were farm goods. And so farmers recognized that the protectionist tariff placed a grossly disproportionate tax burden on them, even though the language of the Constitution talked at the time about proportionate taxation. And so the farmers, who were very politically potent in much of the country, became a potent political lobbying force for a permanent income tax. And so by the time you get to the late 19th century, farmers from states like Missouri were very powerful politically. I did some research on this once related to the origins of antitrust laws, and Missouri had one of the first state antitrust laws. And every member of the state legislature would identify himself if you were a dentist, you would call yourself a farmer dentist. If you were a school teacher, you would call yourself a farmer-teacher, because everyone wanted to win the votes of the farmers, because there were so many of them, they're so powerful. So this was a big voting bloc, a big political campaign contributing bloc, and a deal was cut eventually between the federal government and the farmers. The deal was this: we will reduce the tariff rate back to a reasonable level, say 20 to 22% on average, rather than 50%, if you, the farmers, politically supported income tax, which they did. So they got the income tax in 1913, and the tariff was reduced down to around the 20% range, but then it was very quickly increased to the high 30s with the Fordney-McCumber tariff in the 20s. And then by the time you get to 1929, we had the Smoot-Hawley tariff. The average rate was up all the way to 59.1%. So within about 15 years of the income tax, we had an income tax, the rate of which was already much higher than the original top rate, and historically high tariff rates, the highest ever, 1929, the Smoot-Hawley tariff. So this was a classic bait-and-switch incident where the government baited the farmers into going along with income taxation, and then they reneged on the promise and gave them high tariffs anyway. And that, by the way, was helped to precipitate the Great Depression, the Smoot-Hawley tariff. And so that's sort of a long-run consequence of this policy of protectionism. And as mentioned earlier in the course, Lincoln owed his nomination to his long history of being a protectionist. So this was all part of the Hamiltonian victory that I mentioned in the last class, that Hamiltonianism reigned. The second thing that is part of Lincoln's legacy was, of course, he started the business of corporate bailouts en masse in the government, with the bailouts of the transcontinental railroads. The two of them that were built by the government, the Central Pacific and the Northern Pacific, were chronically bankrupted because they were run by politicians. And so they ran uneconomical rail lines everywhere to buy votes. Any member of Congress and even representatives from the new territories that were not yet states said that, in return for my support for this, I want a rail line over to my community where there might have been 10 people a week riding the train and causing it to lose a lot of money, but that was the price they had to pay to get the votes, and so they did. And so it was run in an enormously uneconomical way, and of course it led to one of the biggest political scandals in American history, the Crédit Mobilier scandal during the Grant administration, where even Grant's Secretary of State was implicated in it, and many of the leading lights of the Republican Party, some of whom went to jail for their role in this, where they set up a dummy corporation to purchase products from the Transcontinental Railroad. And it grossly inflated prices. They might have bought railroad ties for a penny and then sold them to themselves for $100, something like that. And they gave shares of stock to many of their friends and associates and political cronies with insider information about the latest deal of some big purchase of materials from some company that made the materials that would be used to be building more of the Transcontinental Railroad. And so a lot of people became very, very rich with this by giving this stock in return for their political support. And finally, there was some squabbling between some of the participants in this scandal, and one of them went public with it and told the journalism about it, and the rest is history. It became a huge scandal in America. Although Grant, as usual, Grant was never tainted with this, even though I think he had to know about all this. He was the leader of his party, after all. But he was never tainted with it because he was a war hero. Lysander Spooner, although, called Grant the chief murderer of the war. He didn't call him a war hero. And this had negative consequences, too. The corruption that was the inevitable consequence of the victory of Hamiltonianism, the close relationship between business and government, the thing that Jeffersonians had been warning against for 75 years, that was inevitable. And this strengthened the hand later in the century of the so-called progressives who wanted more and more regulation and government control of business, which they got because they could point to all these scandals, and they were blaming it on capitalism, but of course it wasn't capitalism, it was crony capitalism, it was mercantilism that was being practiced here. That's why one of my articles in the Mises Institute book on Reassessing the Presidency, my article on Lincoln is called Abraham Lincoln and the Triumph of Mercantilism, telling this whole story. And so it did strengthen the hand of the progressives, but the corporations won that battle too, for the most part, because much of the regulation that was eventually passed in the late 19th, early 20th century was written by the corporations themselves. The progressives wanted it, but the corporations made sure that it was written in a way that they would benefit from it. Even the Food and Drug Act was written in a way that made it very, very difficult for smaller food and drug companies to compete with the big corporations who were already in the industry. And so the big companies actually were supportive of the Food and Drug Act because they knew it would harm their smaller competitors, and it would also deter potential competitors from coming into the market. And that's how regulation shook out. When they regulated the trucking industry with the Interstate Commerce Commission Act in 1887, the first president of the ICC, Interstate Commerce Commission, was a former railroad president, and they regulated it in a way that created essentially a cartel for the railroad companies where the government set prices, and it set the prices very high. And so all of this was a consequence of all the corruption and the association of business and government that the Jeffersonians understood was a rotten idea, because they had studied British history. They had studied Adam Smith and the Wealth of Nations, and they understood that Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations was one big critique of mercantilism, or this close relationship between business and government. That's what, if Lincoln stood for anything, that's what he stood for, and that has to be a part of his economic legacy. Well, and of course, we see this today in many orders of magnitude worse, especially in light of the bailouts of Wall Street and General Motors and so forth. It's really the same thing. Of course, we had the nationalization of the monetary system with the National Currency Acts and the Legal Tender Acts, the creation of the greenback. There was 100% inflation during the Civil War in the northern states because of the printing of the greenbacks. And the supporters of the National Currency Acts raised it to the treetops precisely because it gave the government so much more power to pursue its ends of an empire as opposed to a constitutional republic. And there again, you have the old Hamiltonian agenda, where Hamilton wanted America to be an empire, whereas Jefferson wanted it to be an empire of liberty, not an empire like the Spanish Empire or the British Empire, but Jefferson called his ideal an empire of liberty. That's how, one of the ways in which he defended the Louisiana Purchase, by the way, that he thought it would, since they were creating a country based on government that would supposedly protect rights to life, liberty, and property, the more people and the bigger the country, the more liberty. That was Jefferson's argument in a nutshell. The Internal Revenue Service was created during the Lincoln administration. There were no federal tax collectors on a permanent basis before that. They were pretty much hired out on a contract basis, but a big new internal revenue bureaucracy was created, and also all of Lincoln's domestic policies, were referred to by a Raleigh, North Carolina newspaper in the last year of the war as the New Deal. This Raleigh, North Carolina newspaper wanted the North Carolinians to give up, the war is over, and they said, besides that, look, we have a Department of Agriculture, we have railroad subsidies, the government can print money now, rejoin the Union and you'll have a New Deal. And so the New Deal wasn't the phrase coined by Franklin Roosevelt, it was a North Carolina newspaper referring to the domestic policies of the Lincoln administration, the New Deal. Okay, and those were the main policies, the policy, economic policy consequences, the nationalization of the money supply of the National Currency Acts, protectionist tariffs for 50 years, the massive corporate welfare, not just for the railroads, but every corporation of every kind began going to Washington asking, where's mine? And a lot of them got it, as far as that is concerned. And one of the big, of course, the public debt skyrocketed. That was another Hamiltonian victory, if you will, the massive public debt. And what that did is to do exactly what Alexander Hamilton wanted it to do many, many decades earlier, and that it tied another group of people, bondholders, to the government. They now had a big interest in making sure there was enough tax revenue in the Treasury to pay off the principal and interest on their bonds. So they became essentially lobbyists for bigger government. And then, of course, the whole industry of the investment banking industry was transformed since they began selling so many government bonds. They too became ironclad compatriots and proponents of bigger government. Because that's how they made their money, marketing government bonds. And of course, Goldman Sachs was born, in other words, in those days. Investment banking per se was not always like this, but with the explosion in government debt during and after the Civil War, it strengthened this aspect of investment banking, of becoming sort of a lobbying arm of the state, or shadow government even, if you will. It certainly is today, with the Treasury Secretary almost always being the former head of Goldman Sachs. Probably the biggest consequence of Lincoln's war, as I call it, is the death of federalism. The system of government that was created by the Founding Fathers was destroyed. Lincoln did not save the Union, he destroyed it and replaced it with a compulsory consolidated empire. And I'm going to quote another person. I'm going to quote the historian Forrest MacDonald, who wrote a good book on states' rights about 10 years ago. And Forrest MacDonald is a retired history professor from the University of Alabama. He's quite a historian and constitutional scholar. He won the award from the National Endowment for the Humanities as sort of the Scholar of the Year one year. So he was a very well-known scholar. He produced many good students. And he wrote this book on states' rights. As far as I know, it's the last book that he wrote. He also wrote several books on the Constitution, the history of the Constitution. And here's what he says about states' rights in the context of Lincoln. He says this, quoting, "Political scientists and historians are in agreement that federalism is the greatest contribution of the Founding Fathers to the science of government. It is also the only feature of the Constitution that has been successfully exported that can be employed to protect liberty elsewhere in the world. Yet what we invented and others imitate no longer exists on its native shores. Federalism no longer exists here in the United States." And of course, the reason he said that is that the cornerstones of federalism were the rights of nullification and secession. That's what, and the 10th Amendment, that's what gave the people themselves the right to decentralize power if they thought power became too centralized. That was all set aside after the war. There is no longer a serious right of nullification, although it's attempting to make a comeback today. And of course, the right of secession was destroyed by by gunpoint at that time. And so federalism became essentially dead. Nowadays, when you hear Republicans talk about federalism, they usually mean first taxing the people of the states and then giving their governor some of the money back to spend on whatever the governor chooses to spend it on, or perhaps things that the federal government orders the governor to choose to spend it on. That's what they call federalism. They used to call it revenue sharing when Nixon was president. But of course, it was the money taken from the people of the states in the first place. The government confiscates it and then says, aren't we wonderful? We're going to share. We're going to send some back. But you have to spend it on what we tell you to spend it on. And that essentially was what fascism was allowing the private sector and the civil society to operate, but only under orders from the central state in terms of how it is you're operating and what you're doing. And so that's not real federalism. That's just government control. But real federalism died because the union was no longer voluntary. And another key feature of this, in my book, Lincoln Unmasked, I quote Woodrow Wilson, who was a political science professor at Princeton for years before he became president. And he wrote a book on Congress. In his book on Congress, he praised the fact that one of the consequences of the Civil War was that after the war, the federal government became the sole arbiter of the limits of its own powers through the Supreme Court. Prior to the war, there was judicial review by the Supreme Court, but presidents often decided that their view of constitutionality was just as valid as the Supreme Court's, as did Congress, because they made the argument that we have three branches of government, not one. And the Constitution does not say who is to be the arbiter of constitutionality. And also the people of the states, as I've mentioned before in the course, took it upon themselves to decide on issues of constitutionality by enforcing the doctrine of nullification invented by Thomas Jefferson. It was invented earlier than that even, but Jefferson is the name most closely attached to nullification. That was all gone. That was all gone by with the Civil War. And Woodrow Wilson, of course, praised it. He said this was a good thing because he knew that the so-called system of checks and balances was destroyed by the war because the three branches of government no longer checked each other. They conspired or colluded with each other to enforce the power and edicts of the central government. And that's the way it is today. You know, who in their right mind would argue today that the so-called system of checks and balances, having three different branches of government limits government? Government is not limited, it's unlimited. But the Civil War was a major breaking point, as far as I'm concerned, with what happened there. And of course, the other legacy that I would mention is Lincoln's rampant destruction of the Constitution, where he was praised by historians as being a dictator, but a great dictator, provided precedents for future would-be destroyers of the Constitution. To this day. That's why I mentioned before the class on the public chat group, someone sent me an email today about a Heritage Foundation lecture being given sometime soon by, I think it's Herman Belts is the speaker, who has written articles and books about the ridiculous notion that Lincoln was somehow a defender of the Constitution. And so I guess since it's Lincoln's birthday month, February, the Heritage Foundation is doing that, but I've talked about that in the past class, about Lincoln and the Constitution, but that's always used as an excuse by people who want to eviscerate the Constitution further, to ignore constitutional limitations on power, especially with regard to personal liberties and civil liberties. They always invoke Lincoln as he did it, therefore it must be a good thing to do. And of course, government was massively centralized. As a result of the Civil War, the states really all became mere appendages of the central government after the war. It wasn't total. It took a while. I think by the time, though, you get to 1913, we had the Fed, the income tax, and the 17th Amendment. Those were the final three nails in the coffin of federalism in America. because the income tax, you know, vastly increased the power of the central government, as did the Fed, and of course the direct election of senators, rather than having them appointed by the state legislatures, also increased the power of lobbyists from everywhere, as opposed to the people back home having more of a say. And so those are the three final nails pounded into the coffin of federalism. But the war that destroyed the rights of nullification and secession, I think, went about at least 90% of the way of destroying the system of federalism that the Founding Fathers created. And as Forrest MacDonald said, it's been exported to other countries like Switzerland, for example, but we no longer have it here in America, as far as that goes. Last week, we talked about total war. That, of course, is another consequence of Lincoln. He opened the door to the waging of total war on civilians. And those of you who saw Tom Woods and me on Freedom Watch last night, Judge Napolitano's show on Fox Business Network, you know that the judge made a big deal of the fact that some 50,000 Southern civilians, mostly women and children, were murdered intentionally by the bombings of the cities and shootings and so forth, not to mention the plundering of property there. And that is it's praised. It's praised by the Lincoln scholars because the ends justify the means. He saved the Union. They will tell you that. And so the whole business of total war was reopened, the Pandora's box of waging total war on civilians, not only in the United States or by the United States government, but worldwide. The final thing I'll mention here is the political uses of the Lincoln myth, the mythology of Lincoln. And I hope you have a chance to read, I only put, I think, two articles on the reading list for tonight. The one is a book review by a book by Larry Tagg called The Unpopular Mr. Lincoln. And I hope it piques your interest in the whole topic of how Lincoln became known as a saint, because he was hated and reviled by most people in the North on the day he died. He was turned into a martyr and a saint by the Republican Party and the New England clergy in the years after the war. But during his lifetime, he was hated. And why wouldn't he be? Conscription, mass arrest of political dissenters, shutting down newspapers, and so forth, high pervasive taxes. Scholars and political activists have used the Lincoln myth for their purposes for a long, long time. In The Real Lincoln, I quote David Donald, the Lincoln biographer, former Harvard professor, as saying that that all political parties of all kinds have tried to attach their agenda, whatever it is, to the Lincoln myth. And he said that even the Communist Party USA used to hold Lincoln-Lenin Day rallies in New York City, and they had giant pictures of Lincoln and Lenin on the walls in their offices in New York City. And of course, the Republicans do that. That's why the Heritage Foundation and Hillsdale College, which has turned into a sort of a propaganda arm of the Republican Party, unfortunately, today, are both holding Lincoln lectures this month. And that's all part of the Republican Party mantra out there. But let me give you some examples of the political uses of the Lincoln myth. There's a neoconservative writer named Walter Burns, B-E-R-N-S, who wrote a book several years ago called Making Patriots. And he's with the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C., and he's a big supporter of the war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan. He wants us to invade Iran. He's online with all that. And in this book, Making Patriots, he makes the case that there's a big problem in America, and that America's young people are too self-centered. They're too interested in educating themselves, starting a career, getting married, raising a family, living a normal life. They're not willing enough to take a few years off, to sacrifice for the good of other people in foreign wars that have nothing to do with America. Walter Burns doesn't say that, but that's what he means. He's talking about the foreign wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, Iran, in his view, hopefully North Korea, you know, wherever these wars are. And so he takes, one of the perversions of the whole Lincoln idea is by the Republican Party and its mouthpieces like Walter Burns, is that they claimed immediately to be the party of great moral ideas, and they translated that into being so essentially Wilsonians, and that if there's trouble anywhere in the world, it's up to us to solve the trouble, to resolve it. And so if there's trouble in the Middle East, we should go there, and not Walter Burns, he shouldn't go there, but America's young people should be put into the military, they should go there. And so, you know, not the chicken hawks, as they're called, like William Bennett or Rush Limbaugh, people like that. No, you know, America's youth. There's a big problem. America's youth are too self-centered. And so Walter Burns, in his book Making Patriots, writes that, well, to solve this problem of how to get more young people to join the military, although we do have a volunteer army and it seems pretty well staffed to me, you know, to this day, he said, we need to inspire patriotism. How to do that? He says this, to inspire patriotism in the nation's youth, a national poet must mesmerize them and unite them in a cause. So we need a national poet who can mesmerize the youth and unite them in a cause. And he says, fortunately, we already have one at hand. That person is Abraham Lincoln, statesman, poet, and the martyred Christ of democracy's passion play. That's how Walter Burns describes Abe Lincoln. All we need to do is to have places like Hillsdale College and the Heritage Foundation and other universities ingrain in the students Lincoln's wonderful rhetoric, not those speeches that sound like they come from a Ku Klux Klan manual, not that stuff that I read to you earlier in the course, but his other flowery political rhetoric. Read them some of that, and that will supposedly inspire them to join the military and go and kill Iranians. And so that's one example. And this is the American Enterprise Institute. This is just not some reclusive crackpot who teaches at a small college in Idaho. This is Walter Burns of the American Enterprise Institute saying that. And so that's one of the consequences of the Lincoln myth. It's used for all sorts of political programs, and it's always interventionist, of course, because Lincoln was a warmonger on war and an interventionist and a mercantilist on economics. And everything he did, domestic policy and the war policy, was totalitarian in its nature. Which is, you know, brings to mind another extraordinarily silly article in the recent issue of National Review by the Lincoln cultist Alan Guelzo, arguing that Lincoln was a classical liberal along the lines of Ludwig von Mises. Nothing could be more the opposite of the truth if you look at what Lincoln actually did, as we've been talking about in this entire class. But the neocons at National Review, Heritage Foundation, Claremont Institute, Hillsdale College, which is a clone of the Claremont Institute, keep saying these things. They state that, you know, light is dark, up is down, black is white. Lincoln was a classical liberal. It's all the same. Another example from the left is Eric Foner, the Marxist historian at Columbia University. In my book, Lincoln Unmasked, I quoted him from a October 1991 issue of The Nation magazine, where he opposed the breakup of the Soviet Union, and the title of the article was Lincoln's Lesson. He made the case that the Soviet Union was a noble experiment, he said, and it shouldn't be broken up, and if they only had an Abe Lincoln, would still have a Soviet Union, and that's his opinion, and that would be a good thing, according to Eric Foner. So you have the Marxist left using the Lincoln mythology to make their case for totalitarian socialism, and you have the fascist right, the American Enterprise Institute, using the Lincoln legend to make the case for more military adventurism in the world. Another aspect of this, you know, this didn't just pop up on its own. There were many decades of propagandizing and the using of the death of Lincoln and the rewriting of history to create this situation of where political agendas can be enhanced by the Lincoln myth. And one part of that was the Pledge of Allegiance. The Pledge of Allegiance was not written until the late 1880s. It had nothing to do with the American Fathers. The author of the Pledge of Allegiance was a defrocked Baptist minister named Francis Bellamy. He was the cousin of Edward Bellamy, who wrote a book, a novel called Looking Backward. And in the novel Looking Backward, a man falls asleep for many decades, sort of like a Rip Van Winkle, and wakes up in the year 2000 where America is a socialist paradise. And so, and by the way, Francis Bellamy was kicked out of the pulpit by his own flock for preaching that Jesus Christ was a socialist. They didn't want that. They wanted to be taught the Bible. They didn't want to be taught socialism. So they kicked him out. And so he wrote the Pledge of Allegiance, which he claimed was modeled after loyalty pledges that Southern Confederate prisoners were forced to take at gunpoint during the Civil War. And here's, in his own words, the purpose of the Pledge of Allegiance. This is Francis Bellamy talking. He said, "The true reason for allegiance to the flag is the, quote, republic for which it stands. And what does that vast thing, the republic, mean? It is the concise political word for the nation, the one nation which the Civil War was fought to prove. To make that one nation idea clear, we must specify that it is indivisible, as Webster and Lincoln used to repeat in their great speeches," end quote. So this was the Hamiltonian vision of a not a one nation, but a highly centralized, monopolistic government that would impose its will on everybody by use of force, coercion, intimidation, and even war. That's what he's talking about, one nation. Of course, the implication of one nation is there's some sort of national unity or unanimity of opinion, which of course can never happen. That was the whole idea of the founders. They realized that human reality is that we're all unique, we're all different, we're going to have differences of opinions, and that a one uniform policy, there might be some room for one uniform policy such as fighting a defensive war, but not for everything. But that's what the socialists of the world always have wanted, and Bellamy was a socialist. He wanted one nation. You can't have socialism and federalism at the same time. As I mentioned, I think in the last class, I quoted Adolf Hitler and these other famous totalitarians as literally attacking the idea of federalism and states' rights, because they're all about control, monopolistic control by government. And if you allow states' rights and federalism, you can't have that. The people have an escape valve. And that indeed is why Jefferson and the Jeffersonians thought that the 10th Amendment was the cornerstone of the whole Constitution, because allowing the people and the states to reserve all the non-delegated powers to themselves gave them multiple escape routes from tyranny. And so the tyrants of the world recognize that too, and that's why they've always been champions of the centralized state. And so when you say the Pledge of Allegiance, one nation indivisible, that is sort of meant to inculcate in the minds, especially of children, this whole Lincolnian idea of monopoly government, the Hamilton, Clay, Lincoln idea of government, which was assisted also by Daniel Webster, Joseph Story, and other people that I mentioned in earlier classes. And of course, Bellamy went right to work with the schools. They got all of this. They worked with the public schools all over the United States to get school children everywhere to say the Pledge of Allegiance, beginning in the 1890s. And if you were to look this up on the web, Google Origins of Pledge of Allegiance, you'll find a website by a man, what's his name, Rex. His first name is Rex. I can't think of his last name, but you'll find it. Got a website with a guy named Rex something. He has all these pictures of school children in the 1920s, 1910s, holding their arms out. So if I can put in a picture, kind of like this, kind of like Hail Caesar. But in the 1930s, it was discontinued because it was too similar to this and what the Nazis and the fascists in Italy were doing. And so it was discontinued. But it is kind of creepy. If you find these pictures on the web, you'll see all these young school children holding their arms out, like almost making like a Nazi salute. Yeah, Chris Branco says Rex Curry. Yeah, that's the guy's name, Rex Curry. And you can find that on the web pretty easily, I think. Another example of the political uses of the Lincoln legend that I've written about is Michelle Malkin, the neoconservative media pundit. She wrote a book several years ago entitled In Defense of Internment, and where she made the case for rounding up Muslim Americans and putting them in concentration camps, as was done with Japanese Americans during World War II. And she was interviewed about the book by the Heritage Foundation, a very friendly interview. And she said this to defend her proposal to round up Muslim Americans because they're Muslim Americans and put them in concentration camps where they can be watched. She said, quote, historically, civil rights have often yielded to security in times of crisis. During the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln suspended habeas corpus, which enabled him to detain thousands of rebels and subversives without access to judges. And she's saying that's a good thing. And of course, these weren't rebels and subversives. They were the mayor of Baltimore, Maryland legislators, newspaper editors. Anybody who criticized Lincoln, essentially, was put in jail. Not a lot of rebels were in the army. Subversives, yeah, they were subversives. They were people who criticized Lincoln. And so once again, she invokes the Lincoln legend to make the argument that Lincoln did it, therefore it must be God's will. I think I might have mentioned in the class at some point also that Newt Gingrich published an article in the Wall Street Journal Online several years ago. I think the title was Lincoln and Bush, either that or Bush and Lincoln, where he made the case for invading, a military invasion of Iran, Saudi Arabia, Lebanon, Syria, and North Korea at the same time. And of course, the title was Lincoln and Bush. And he made the case that Bush should be more like Lincoln and do this. And so it's almost never ending. And I guess the final thing I'll say is I'll urge you to read the one article I put on the list was a sort of a review, also another book review, of this great little book by Robert Penn Warren, the famous novelist, called The Legacy of the Civil War by Robert Penn Warren. It's not very thick. See how thick it is. And in 1960, Robert Penn Warren was asked to write this book, The Legacy of the Civil War, because it was for 1961, it was the 100th anniversary of the start of the Civil War. And so he wrote it, and one of the memorable phrases in there is, he said, the war gave the U.S. government, or so it thought, a treasury of virtue. And the main point is that the rewriting of history, many of the things that we've talked about that happened were not that virtuous, but the rewriting of history and relying on that history allowed the government to, and Americans who supported the government, to say that whatever the government does, anything, is virtuous by definition, by virtue of the fact that it's the U.S. government doing it, because it had so much virtue and righteousness that it was just beyond question when it did what it did to the Indians. That was by definition virtuous because it was the U.S. government doing it. And the same with everything else, the Spanish-American War, entry into World War I eventually, treasury of virtue. And so that's another one of the legacies that I think is very dangerous and a very bad precedent, this idea. And I see this to this day. That's why so many people get so angry when I recite, undeniable historical facts about Lincoln that they just don't like. They've been brainwashed into this treasury of virtue, and they think that they themselves are virtuous by virtue of the fact that they support the government. It's not just the government that is virtuous. It's a lot of millions of Americans think that they are the most virtuous people in the world because they are a part of this government that was refounded by Abraham Lincoln. And of course, I'm working on a book on that called False Virtue, that I hope to criticize that in a number of ways. And I see it's about 8:20, so I think maybe that's all I'll do for now in terms of lecturing. And I'll start looking at some questions here. And I had one. Well, before the class, I checked out the questions for the professor, and there was just one by Terry Ryan, a question about Lincoln's cabinet. Terry says, Bush, President Bush, had an entire cabinet made up of neocons in Bush for the Iraq War. Well, Lincoln's entire cabinet was made up of former Whigs like himself. And the Whig Party, there were Northern Whigs and Southern Whigs. A lot of the Southern Whigs, like John C. Calhoun, was a Southern Whig for a while, but he left once he found out who the Northern Whigs, who he was consorting with, really were. But the Northern Whigs, you know, what did they stand for? Protectionism, centralized banking, corporate welfare, big public debt, mercantilism on economic policy, and they also wanted America, many of them, to be an empire and not a constitutional republic. They thought the purpose of government was to become an empire like the British Empire, as opposed to the Jeffersonians, who thought the purpose of government was to protect God-given rights to life, liberty, and property. And so that's who the Whigs were. And every member of Lincoln's cabinet was a former Whig, you know, at one point, and so like him. And so it was pretty unanimous. And just like all the neocons in Bush's cabinet, you know, there were no libertarians there at all. At least Reagan had a few, such as James Miller, the economist, who was the head of the Federal Trade Commission. He's a pretty libertarian guy. I met him many years ago, and there were others like that, but not with George W. Bush. That was the Reagan cabinet. That's what I know about it. I did write one article about this on lewrockwell.com when Doris Kearns Goodwin came out with this book, Team of Rivals. And when Obama was elected, she was all over the place, and other people were quoting her and saying, you know, what a great guy Obama is, because he appointed a Republican or two to his cabinet. He kept Bush's defense secretary, for example. And she says, well, Abe Lincoln did that. Abe Lincoln was such a wonderful guy that people that he competed against within the Republican Party were given jobs in his cabinet. Isn't that remarkable? Well, I went through my book of presidents. I have one of these book of presidents that lists all the facts and figures of all the presidents, who's in their cabinet, who the people were who were in the cabinet. And I wrote this article on lewrockwell.com about how this has always been the case. That's, you know, who are you going to appoint to your cabinet? You're a member of a political party, and you might have 7 or 8 or 9 people who are top people in the party who think they have a chance of winning a presidential election. They all compete. You're the winner. Who are you going to pick from your political party to be on the cabinet? It's going to be some of these people, because they were some of the most experienced people in your party to begin with. That's why they were competing with you for the job of president. And so I just went down examples through history from my book of presidents to show that this was not unique among for Lincoln any more than it was unique for somebody born in the early 19th century to live in a log cabin. All these stories about Lincoln being so unique, poor Abe lived in a log cabin. Well, so did it just about everybody on the American frontier in those days. And he wasn't unique in appointing these people to his cabinet either. And so, but that's all I know about, I'll say about that. Now, let me see if there's some questions on the public chat here. Yeah, that's good. Cliff got the links to the Pledge of Allegiance stuff. Mike said he was criticizing the pledge in front of a conservative group. That's not, you know, they don't like that, that's for sure. And there are several articles on lewrockwell.com on the pledge. I wrote one, and there's several others as well. Let's see. Let's see, Mike has a question. Can I comment on the Second Amendment issues under Lincoln, if any? The invasion James Madison, one of the reasons James Madison used to defend the Second Amendment was that a well-armed populace would be a deterrent to any future invasion of the sovereign states by the central government. They didn't trust the central government. That's why they wrote the Constitution. the whole invasion of the South was an attack on the Seventh Amendment, because the firearms were confiscated in mass, of course, and they were all throughout the border states. The border states, like Maryland, was an occupied territory during the war. About 20 members of the Maryland state legislature were imprisoned without due process at the very beginning of the war, and it was an occupied state. And of course, the firearms were confiscated in Maryland and Kentucky and other border states in clear violation of the Second Amendment. Let's see. Is there any way that debt and unfunded liabilities can be paid? The current debt, no. The government will inflate it away and or just walk away from the debt, so some combination of those. Let's see. A whole bunch of questions by Mike here. How much of a push is there to overturn 1913 across the nation? Well, I don't know. I haven't taken a survey, but that's what the Ron Paul End the Fed movement is about. So that was part of 1913. The income tax, Ron Paul has also advocated abolishing the income tax. When he ran for president, he pointed out correctly that at that time when he was running, if you abolished the income tax and replaced it with nothing, just the next year the federal budget would be about what it was in 1997. In the 1997 federal budget was still grossly overblown compared to what the Constitution would allow. And that would have been a great thing for the U.S. private economy, too. And so Ron Paul and the Ron Paulians are talking about this, for sure. But I can't forecast what will happen. Who knows what will happen with all that. Let's see. I get some other questions from other people here. Is the Lincoln as white supremacist route our best bet for getting folks to listen to the truth? I don't know if it's the best bet, but I don't see any reason why people should not be informed that Lincoln was a white supremacist. When this book comes out any day now by Phil Magnus and a co-author, showing that to his dying days, Lincoln was planning and plotting to deport all the freed slaves because he did not think it would be possible to have a workable democracy with black and white races together. I think that is going to have a big impact on the Lincoln legend, be a good opportunity to educate people more about what he was. But also, the second thing that's just as important is for people to begin understanding that at least 50,000 women and children were murdered by the U.S. Army during the Civil War, and that these were fellow Americans that were waged war on. These were not invading armies. These were fellow citizens and women and children and feeble old men that were killed with the bombing and burning of the cities and the plundering and so forth. Most Americans know nothing at all about this, and it's not an accident that the public schools have not taught Americans the horror of the mass killing of tens of thousands of women and children by the U.S. Army in the southern states during the war. And the third thing that no one seems to know about is that every other country in the world that ended slavery in the 19th century did it peacefully. That's why I keep citing Jim Powell's book, Greatest Emancipations, How the West Ended Slavery. It tells chapter and verse about how that happened, because most Americans think even if Lincoln was a bad guy, if he was a white supremacist and he orchestrated the murder of civilians, it ended slavery. Well, we didn't have to end slavery that way. It could have been ended the way New Jersey and New York ended slavery, peacefully. We didn't have to end it this way. The slaves were used as political pawns. And those are the three things I would try to educate people on. But some people just don't want to be educated. Some people don't want to admit that they've been fooled and taken and made fools of, and so they'll be angry at it. But there are a lot of open-minded people out there. I've just been emailing the last 2 days with a black guy who got wind of my writings, and I've been telling him these things, and he's told me already that he caused a big argument with his family over this. And so you never know who you'll reach and who you'll get to educate themselves on these things. Let's see, what else we have here? No, I haven't read Alan Guelzo's Mr. Lincoln's Economics Primer. I read the first couple of paragraphs, and it was ridiculous. And I've read it all before. I've heard it all before from Alan Guelzo, who doesn't have a degree in either history or economics and doesn't know what he's talking about. So it's the idea that that Lincoln was a classical liberal is a real laugh. It's a real laugh. No classical liberal was a protectionist. Just that disqualifies him as a classical liberal. Yeah, criminals and immigrants recruited by the Union Army, that they had a lot to do with the killing of civilians, that's for sure. The book I mentioned, Philip Magnus, M-A-G-N-E-S-S. He has a co-author who's a British co-author. Yeah, it's a book on colonization. If you go on Amazon.com and just type in his name, Phil Magnus, M-A-G-N-E-S-S, you'll find the book, and you can probably buy it. I don't know if the release date is here yet, but it's imminent, any day now. Let's see. I'm still researching and writing a book on Henry Clay. It's not coming out yet. There's one question here. Rob wants to know if I might do a course on Hamilton and Jefferson. That might be an interesting thing to do. And my next course is on competition, monopoly, and antitrust, the Austrian perspective. So it's going to be pure economics as far as that goes. But Hamilton and Jefferson would be a good course. Maybe I can get Tom Woods to even teach it. Let's see. Mike wants to know how many buffaloes were killed in the Wild West. I'm not sure, a lot. I remember quoting somebody saying that the entire Great Plains reeked of dead animal carcasses for years because of the mass killing of the buffaloes. Yeah, Colonization After Emancipation, and Terry looked up the book, Lincoln and the Movement for Black Resettlement. I have the manuscript here on my desk, but I don't have Phil. He's going to send me the book, and I'm going to review it on lewrockwell.com as soon as it comes out. And so, Danny puts my new course up there. It's a 5-week course on competition, monopoly, and antitrust. And the buffaloes are bison. They weren't always called buffalo, but bison, the American bison. Let's see, any more questions? Yeah, the white supremacist language is what gets a lot of people in shock. They weren't taught that because the government doesn't teach, government schools don't teach the unflattering things about itself. Rob wants to know if did Jefferson's concept of limited government and protection of liberty take root? Well, it wasn't just Jefferson's. You know, he inherited a lot of these ideas from people like Adam Smith, who was Scottish, and John Locke, who was British. And the French libertarian economists known as the physiocrats. Jefferson was the American purveyor of those ideas more than anybody else. There are other kinds of, Switzerland, these ideas are alive today. Germany, until the late 19th century, Germany had many classical liberals who were followers of the Jeffersonian tradition. They were eventually overtaken by the time you get to Otto von Bismarck as the Chancellor of Germany. He turned that around, but there were many classical liberals at that time in the mid-19th century there, in England as well. That's the Dutch. The Dutch were the first capitalists, really. And so these ideas of limited government were developed first in Europe and then came to America. And were expanded upon in America. Let's see. Terry Ryan, who was the French economist? Jefferson's favorite French economist was Turgot, T-U-R-G-O-T is how it's spelled. And there's his name is on the wall at the Mises Institute. There are names on the walls on the second floor of famous precursors to the Austrian School of Economics and more modern ones. And Turgot is one of them. If you go into Monticello, Jefferson's home, there was a bust of Turgot next to the front door. And also, if you look up French physiocrats on the web, P-H-Y-S, physiocrats, it was a school of thought in France before Adam Smith. They didn't get it all right, but they were among the first to begin studying and understanding how free markets work and the virtues of voluntary trade and limited government and so forth. And Jefferson knew about them, to be sure. He knew about Adam Smith also. He read The Wealth of Nations. Okay, and Lord Acton, of course, that was a great historian of liberty, British historian of liberty. I don't know if Bismarck quoted Lincoln. I tried to find that once, but I didn't spend a lot of time on it. I would bet that he did, but I didn't really spend a lot of time trying to find Bismarck quotes of Lincoln. I went to a university library and got the collected works of Otto von Bismarck, which might be online. I don't know. I never looked. There might be an index. We'll find that. A.R.J. Turgot. Yeah, Jean-Baptiste Say was another Danny mentions that Jefferson knew about. Friedrich Bastiat, he wrote in the late 1840s. And of course, Jefferson died in the 1820s, and so he was long gone by the time Friedrich Bastiat, French economist, came around and was active. But Bastiat certainly knew about Jefferson. Yes, Say of Say's Law, same guy. Charles is asking. Let's see if I can find another question or two up top here somewhere. Yeah, Doris Kearns, plagiarist. Dennis says, yeah, I have a review of her book on. Okay, let's see if we have any more questions here. And Mike wants to know, do my students appreciate what I'm doing? I think some of them do. Yeah, most students just want to get grades, and they're sort of grade mongers. But sure, I think they do. My classes are always totally full, more full than any of the other economics professors at my university. So much so that the economics department put a limit on the number of students that I can have in my elective courses. And the department chairman told me it's only fair to do that, to spread the students around. Because, so if I have a limit of, say, 30, but there are 40 who want to take the class, that'll leave 10. If they want to graduate, they have to take so many electives, and it'll be a force them to take electives from some of the other faculty and some of their boring courses. And so my courses are always overflowing. I always let a few extra sneak in, even from other universities. I have one student from Johns Hopkins University now, which is only about a half mile away from my university, and I let her in and to the class. And she's a libertarian who tells me she has seen every video on the Mises web already. She said she spent the whole summer last summer watching the Mises videos, the economics lectures. Okay, well, the questions seem to be dying down. Let's see. Venice wants to have t-shirts. Yeah, some of my students, a couple years ago, the seniors, for senior week, they had softball tournaments, and they had t-shirts made with my picture on the back, and it said Enemy of the State on the bottom of it. And I had students at Washington University, where I gave a speech once. Some young lady had a t-shirt made out It said dictator to-do list, and it listed all these things that Lincoln did: suspension of habeas corpus, wage war on civilians, and bullet points of all these things. And then she said something about how Lincoln did it. I thought that was pretty funny. Okay. Well, it looks like the questions have died down then, so I guess we'll call it a course, and I'll be making up a quiz for those of you who want to get some kind of a grade. We'll do that again, and Danny says the non-PayPal credit card system is fixed. Okay. Yeah, Rothbard enemy of the state shirt I see there. I was wearing one of those in the country of Turkey several years ago, and a local shopkeeper pointed to me and said, Al Capone. He thought the silhouette of Murray Rothbard was Al Capone. Okay, well, thanks for attending, and I hope to see you in a future course. Hamilton and Jefferson sounds interesting. I actually have thought about that, doing that, so that might be a possibility also. So, and I guess, thanks a lot, and have a good night. And I'll be on lewrockwell.com tomorrow with an audio interview with Lou Rockwell and the new article, if anyone's interested. So take care. Feel free to email me at any time, by the way, for about anything, now that you're formerly my former students.